Ladies and gentlemen. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 300th episode of Tell the Damn Story, the show that celebrates the trials and tribulations and shares our successes and failures in hopes of making your creative journey easier. There you go. I am a hybrid author and micro-publisher named Christopher Ryan. That's me. And I'm honored to have been on this whole journey with the legendary author of everything from Archie to Scooby-Doo to Batman to his own African-American soldier of fortune, Aaron Blackjack Day. We're speaking of the one and only mythic Alex Simmons. Alex, we have so many guests today.
Yes, we do. Oh, wait a minute. I got to try this. Here we go. Let's see if this works now. Yes, there we go. Balloons.
Brought balloons, ladies and gents.
Hey, Chris, how you doing? Everybody, Chris introduced himself. So you know from 299 other episodes that what I think of him. And I'm not going to do that now because this is a family show. So right. I would like to welcome everybody who's come here to be here today. This is our 300th episode, and I will point out one quick thing. You see the guy, that gentleman with the shining dome in the center? There's two guys.
Thank you very much.
The one with the artwork around him, that is Mr. Tim Fielder. So welcome home, Tim.
That's great, okay. Man. Pleasure to be back, man. Pleasure to be back.
Founder of Tell the Damn Story those years ago.
So, Chris, you get to introduce all of these wonderful people because we got a hell of a show.
If you could be kind enough to just give us a wave as I start talking so everybody knows who's who. Janine Agassin is a former middle school English teacher, dragged kicking and screaming 4 years ago into writing novels and comics with her friend and writing partner, Tom Snagowski. James Chambers is an author and editor and a Bram Stoker Awards-winning writer of Kolchak the Night Stalker, The Forgotten Lore of Edgar Allan Poe, as well as the short stories collections On the Night Border, On the Hairfront Road, and A Bright and Beautiful Eternal World. He is the editor of Under the Twin Suns, Alternate Histories of the Yellow Sign, and co-editor of Even in the Grave, and A New York State of Fright. Rebecca Cuthbert writes dark poetry and feminist and gothic horror. Her latest book, Creep This Way, How to Become a Horror Writer with 24 Tips to Get You Ghouling, is out now from the legendary Seamus and Nunzio Productions. Jersey Draws lives in Columbus, Ohio. He co-founded Kids Read Comics, who helps put the Ann Arbor Comics Arts Festival on. He served as the interim executive director of Cartoon Crossroads in Columbus, but now works as a teaching artist leading comics residencies in schools. His next middle grade graphic novel, The Inscrutable Dr. Bear and The Case of the Two-Faced Statue, comes out in September.
Try saying that six for me times to fast. Say.
There you go. Tim Fielder, as we said, co-founder of Tell the Damn Story. He is a Glyph Award-winning illustrator, cartoonist, and animator raised in Clarksdale, Mississippi. I was right the first time. He is founder of Diesel Funk Studios and has taught at the New York Film Academy and Howard University. His clients include Ubisoft Entertainment, TriStar Pictures, and Marvel. He lives in New York City. Let's see. Teal James Glenn has been a stuntman, swordsmaster, storyteller, bodyguard, actor, and haunted house barker. All of that is fed into his fiction. Over 200 magazines, including Weird Tales, Mystery, Mad, and Sherlock Holmes Mystery, have had his work in there. His novel, A Cowboy in Carpathia, a Bob Howard adventure, won the Best Novel 2021 in the Pulp Factory Awards, and his SNS novel, Journey to Stormrest, is a finalist for that award this year.
There'll be a test later, everybody, so I hope you're taking notes.
His website is theurbanswashbuckler.com. Carol Geisander. Yes, Carol. She's a Bram Stoker Award finalist and writes and edits horror, weird fiction, and science fiction, often with strong women in twisted tales that touch your heart. Carol is the co-chair of the HWA New York chapter, along with James Chambers, and co-host of their monthly Galactic Terrors online reading series. Great show. Check it out on YouTube, ladies and gentlemen. You can find Carol Geisander at carolgeisander.com or on social media at Carol Geisander. Omar Holman, ladies and gentlemen, is the founder and one of the stars of the Black Nerd Problems, a platform and pop culture outlet covering all things cool. He's also the co-author of the great pop culture essay collection, also named Black Nerd Problems, and a really cool book of poetry. And Omar, I forgot the title of that book. What's that?
We Were All Someone Else Yesterday.
There you go. I was someone else yesterday and remembered, but today. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think we have gotten everybody. We want to. Tom Snagowski.
Hello.
So sorry. Tom, the problem, Tom, was that it was in big and bold face, and somehow that wasn't enough for me in my advanced
red
age.
Next time.
Tom Snagowski is a New York Times bestselling author of over 40 novels and has written more comics for just about every major comic publisher than he cares to count. Currently, he's writing more comics and cooking up some book stuff for the not too distant future with his writing partner, Janine Atkinson. See how it comes around in a full circle. You can always trust Boston. Later on, Tom and Janine are going to reenact the Dunkin' Donuts commercial because they're from Boston. No. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, oh my God, what a crew of
stellar
guests.
Well, that was episode
one.
So, be with us next week.
Yeah. The introductions did take a while, but they were worthwhile. You all deserve praise. What we're going to do today is Alex and I, and this is where the audience really gets grateful. We're going to mostly shut up. And we're going to, let's see if we can have our stellar guest panel here discuss a couple of different things. I have a couple of questions that we cooked up. And then Alex is going to unleash the audience on the authors. Good luck to you all. I don't know how that's going to work out because there's some wild questions coming. But we're going to start off with a question about process, if you don't mind. We've spoken about it often over the episodes, but it would be great to hear what you have to say. So a lot of the cliche questions are, where do you get your ideas? We don't really want to know about that, but we'd love to talk to you or hear what you have to say about how you know that you have an idea that is worth writing about. Whether it's a clip that Omar is going to do for Black Nerd Problems, or something you're going to teach the students jersey, or something you're going to do one of your spectacular art pieces for Tim, or write about the rest of you. How do you know when you have that's the one? Let's start with Teal. Yeah,
I wake up thinking about it. If it's not the first thought in my mind that day, then I'm not supposed to do it. I do a lot of my work in my head before I get up. So I usually will wake up with the next scene in the book I'm working on or the next idea right there. Even if I don't get to it for 3 or 4 hours because there's crap in the morning and life and all that. But it literally is the first thing in my head every day when I get up. It won't let me not do it.
Well, let's get someone to add to that. That's a great answer to you.
I guess if I
own me own,
it makes me laugh.
If it makes you laugh, that's good.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, I think this is funny. And then breaking down, like, oh, why do I think this is funny? Has anyone else made this joke before? If they have made this joke before, what can I do to either to come at a different angle or and build out a story from it so that it's something different? Maybe something it can be something we all know about, but oh, it's told through this different lens or a different perspective of looking at that thing. Especially if it involves humor. Like I think about the Karate Kid. I'm like, oh, wow, Karate Kid 2. Oh, everyone remembers the first one, the first movie in Karate Kid, like the crane kick and everything. I'm like, the second one is way wilder. He was 17 years old in a whole nother country in a life or death fight for his summer vacation. So thinking of it like from that angle, like really looking at it like that, that's hilarious. And also dangerous, because what if he died? What was Miyagi going to tell his mom? Like, what was the end game there? So like things like that, and so like a new way of looking at something, it doesn't matter like how old it is or how new it is, you can always be like more relevant again in a way to make it like evergreen as well.
Excellent. Let's get one or two more if you don't mind. Rebecca and then Carol. All right.
I think I just have to start writing it. Like I have to try it. There's no way to know if it's going to work or not until I get a few pages in.
So you just dive into the deep end.
Just like diving in, and then I'm with Omar that if it's like horror comedy, usually if I'm laughing while I'm typing, I'm like, okay, this is some, or if I think the characters are compelling or I've got a really good setting or something. And then if I finish the draft and I come back to it a few days later and it just feels like I don't really feel anything about this, then usually I'll let it sit, maybe move to something else.
Okay. Does it ever come back? Haunt you again?
Yeah, it does. Right. So sometimes I delete things all the way, and sometimes I just leave them in what I call cold storage. I put an NW next to the file. It means needs work, and I just forget about it, and I can come back to it if I want to in the future.
Cool. Thank you. Carol, what are you saying?
I feel like it has to be difficult in a way. If it's just too easy to write, then it probably doesn't have enough to it. I like I say twisted tales that touch your heart. So it's got to take something out of me to put into it. Or the other difficult part is I wonder what kind of reaction people are going to have to it, and if it's going to actually affect anybody, or if they'll just say there's another story. So,
All right. Jersey, how about you? What makes you bring something to class or create something?
So has anybody here, and I'm sure a lot of us have had the experience where you're in a relationship with somebody and you tell them something over and over again, and then 3 years later they say to you that idea with the sparkle of wisdom, "Hey, have you ever thought about this?" And you go, "Hey, I've just been saying it for 3 years." For me, it's like having that conversation with myself. Like it'll dawn on me, like some learning that has been a steep curve for me in terms of like just how I see the world, how I perceive my relationships, who I am as a person. And suddenly I'll blink and go, "Oh, that's so brilliant." And then I think for 2 seconds, "Oh yeah, that's what I've been learning for like the past 3 years." That's when I know that it has some juice in it.
Oh, excellent. Wow. James, let's ship it up to Boston. Let's get Tom and Janine up to Boston as it is.
Don't worry, James, you'll get your shot.
We're going to finish strong with James and then the mighty Tim. So there we go. Let's say Janine first.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, Jersey, because probably 40 years ago, Tom had a story for a children's book, and he mentioned it to me. And it wasn't until we put our heads together that we actually started writing it.
40 years later.
Yeah. So it's something that's I think it's something that's very insistent, something that doesn't die. That's, I think our little Halloween head story is exactly that. It's something literally 40 years in the making.
Yeah. It's,
Tom, you agree?
It's like something that won't leave you alone. You think about it, you say, "Oh, that's cool." And you go about your business, but it keeps coming back. It's still there. It's waving to get your attention. It may take 40 years, but eventually you pay attention.
Yeah, it goes to the Stephen King thing about letting them fight it out in your head.
Yeah.
And the idea that climbs up out of the top, bloodied and still surviving. That's the one.
James?
James, sir.
I was just going to add one. I think I to some extent, I do all of the sort of the techniques people are talking about. But the one that lately seems to be the most driving force between me or for me to decide it's time to write something is if a deadline is coming up.
There you go.
That's hardcore reality there.
Yeah, and I think that's just part of it's an interesting part of the process from my perspective, because I love having these ideas we just knock around. Following on what Tom and Janine said, I had an idea for a short story in the 90s and just couldn't make it work. And about 15 years later, there was an anthology call. And I just, that idea popped back into my head and all of a sudden it clicked. But it took that long for it to just be sitting there in the subconscious for the piece that made it work to come to me. I like what Rebecca says about keeping these old files needs work. Just, you never know when you're going to go back to something.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Let's go to the professor, Dr. Tim Fielder. We give him all the titles. Tim, you break new ground with art, with who can tell a story, how the story is going to be told. How do you know when it's time?
It's when it lets me. It's when it lets you. Yeah, because sometimes stories come to me in visuals first, but there's no written narrative context with those images. It's just a dope image. You're looking at it, like, wow, there's a story here, but it won't let me know what it is. So I have to wait. So like Infinitum, I created back in 2004. Oh, there it is. 2004. But then the story didn't form into something that was solid till 2016.
There you go.
When it was a New York Times story where they were going to feature it before this was even a book deal. But then after that, I was like, oh, this is it. And it was 24 images that, of course, expanded into almost 300 images at the end. So it's always iterative. It's always over a period of time. And I've had to learn to respect the process that I can't do that story until it's ready to be told.
That's excellent.
So as for the sequel for Infinitum, for example, I'm employing elements that I've had wrote down in 1997. Cool. That'll now be in that story. That's but I didn't know where that fit, but now I know where it fits. Excellent. There we go.
Excellent. I want to shift gears a little bit, but thank you. That was a great set of answers there. One of the things that Alex and I and various guests have talked about numerous times, especially over the last 5 years or so, has really spoken to cultural challenges. So what I'd love to hear you talk about, if you can, is how do you handle the question of whether writers can write about other genders, identities, ethnicities, and or religion? Who gets to write about what, and how do you handle that?
I'll start again. Look
at that. Omar just said hell with it, and he left.
I'm out of here. None of this nonsense.
Yo, I was like, this is like the wrong time this for question? This.
No, I'm out.
No, I'll start again because I'm not as white as it gets. I'm a white cis old guy, so in theory, I can only write about Scots Irish guys of my generation. But I was also an actor, and I have played every ethnic group except African because of my accent work. And doing that, you have to respect the thing you're doing. And don't approach it as this is me and my background. You have to seep yourself in the world and go to as many first person sources as possible and run it by the people you are representing or affecting. I wrote a story from the point of view of a guy coming of age and discovering he's gay in the Midwest in 1946. I don't have any of that, but I ran it by a friend of mine who was Mr. Stonewall from 2019, and he cried reading the story. He said, how did you know this? And I think it comes down to empathy. You can't approach something with an agenda. You have to approach it with the concept of, I want to understand this, and I want to be there and be as authentic with that as you humanly can. I don't even try to write modern street lingo. I can't even write modern white guy street lingo for a 20-year-old. I have the advantage of writing a lot of period stuff, so I have a lot of period stuff to draw on. But if I'm writing something modern, I run it by somebody who is. I run my women characters past women. I run my gay characters past gay people. I run my black characters past people who have that experience, because I don't. I still remember the first time I had to become the token for my buddy who he's Native American, but essentially presents as black. It's that mix. And I had to get him cabs. And I had to literally hold the door and put a foot in the cab for him to be able to get in. Because the first couple of times, as soon as he came out from behind me to get in the cab, the driver took off, the cab door open. And you have to put yourself in that experience or you just can't do it right. And you have to listen when someone says, no, that we wouldn't say white men. We'd say white people. The little details that matter. Oh, no, Dene would not point with the finger. It would be with the chin because it's impolite to point with your finger. The little details matter. It's just like anything else as a writer. Do your homework. If you got guns, get the guns right. Ask somebody who knows.
I think that's a really getting checking in with someone and checking in with a group and with people. Like, that is the important part. I think you get dangerous when it's a writer like, oh, I got this. Like, when they don't have that empathy. And it's like, oh, no, I can know the. Oh, no, you. No, you cannot. No, you cannot. I was having this conversation with it was years ago. Whatever, we're all writers. When Brian Michael Bendis made Miles Morales, he started talking about race. And it was just, oh, I don't want to be the Black Spider-Man. I want to just be Spider-Man. And it's like, oh, God, we're going friggin' back here again. And maybe that's a conversation that happens sometimes. But it's like when you're a Black person here, and you're like, dog, I. And so, and also hearing it's coming from a white dude writing this, and it's just like, it feels rookie. However, I was talking to the point, she wasn't comfortable when it was like a white person writing like a Black character. However, it's been proven that there are white writers that can do that. You look at Kelly Sue DeConnick with her work in Bitch Planet, where she's writing about a Black woman having to change herself and like, taking a hot comb to her hair. And like the nervousness of that, because those are two different cultural things happening right there, right? And in the twist end of like how she loves herself in the end, oh, you didn't expect that coming. And that was written by Kelly Sue DeConnick. Al Ewing, who was writing on Marvel, he had a really good writing with this character, Blue Marvel, who's a Black man, and Luke Cage. And they're just talking to each other. It's about their difference of opinions on how they approach things, where Blue Marvel was a character that stepped down when people found out he was Black, and Luke Cage, well, maybe he should have stepped up. And they're like, they're arguing with each other, and it feels, and it's a way of talking about race without talking about it, which is a skill there. He never implies race, but like, just these two Black men having the conversation, it does the work for you. You didn't have to fill in the gaps there. I'm doing the work. It's just these that we don't normally get to see. It does the work for you, and your mind can go wherever with that. Same thing as he's done with Storm, where like Storm is only used as in X-Men, Storm is used as a weapon, whereas we see her as a woman, a human, all these different aspects, which has not happened in, let's say, 30 years, something like that. So like it, and this is a white dude doing it too, and like an online joke has become like, you find out the Black community just accepted Al Ewing. Like, he's, oh man, he's cooked. We didn't, finding out like, oh wow, it's like finding out when Rick Astley was that dude. Like, no, we're going to give you up. When finding out that dude, like, oh, he's white. He thought he was a Black dude at first. Oh, he's white. And like, for Avery, it became like a running joke, Al Ewing. You're like, oh, huh, didn't, all right, he looks like he's right out of Lord of the Rings. Oh, but okay, all right, cool. So I think it is something when you're just writing them as human, and writing them in these situations, and the work is done like just because you don't normally get to see those characters in those situations. And also, I think a big thing of, okay, I'm just writing them as humans, writing them as characters in the situation, but also knowing when you can't do something and having the being able to have someone else step in for that can. I think that's a big thing. It shouldn't be like a pride as a, maybe it's checking your own ego and pride where, okay, I know, and maybe this would be a better thing to hand off to somebody else, so that they can like step it up, and then I just come back around to do another part as well. So I think that really resonated with what Teal was saying.
Omar, can Excellent. You just show a little bit more passion for what you're saying?
Sorry.
No more Coca-Cola for you, young man.
Carol?
I drink ginger ale because I like to pretend it's scotch because it burns.
And then the bubbles go right to his head, yeah.
It explains the hair.
I think it's really important to think about why you're doing something with your characters. And very often people feel the need to explore or expand the characters in their story. And they say, oh, all right, I've got to get some different people in there for me. So I'm going to have, let's see, I'll make the sidekick a person of color who's gay or alternately gendered and this, that, and the other. And then I'll kill them off and make the story easier. And that's not serving anything.
No,
it doesn't make your story better. It's not really connecting with the way people should be interacting or do interact. It's just checking off something on a list. And I also very much agree with the idea of talking to people who know what it is you're trying to explore in this character. Check in with sources.
Here.
How about James, who has written everything from Kolchak to Cthulhu?
that still took sounds.
That's right.
Right. Yeah, I think that the keys for me, some of them have already been touched on, are to do your homework, do your research, and be respectful of what you know you're doing and who you're writing. My sort of default position when I write anything is writers are supposed to be observers of the world around us. And so anything I write, I'm drawing on the world that I see around me, experience around me. And I think about the characters and what is their world? Who would be in their world? And so I generally populate that world with the people that I would see in the equivalent world in reality. I have, as most of us do, I think we've had the benefit of spending a lot of time in big cities, New York or Boston, where we just in day-to-day life encounter a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds. We interact with people and we just have a maybe a broader sense of what makes up the world around us than people in who don't spend a lot of time in big cities might have. I don't want to sound like I'm making people who don't live in big cities sound bad, but I think you just have to draw on that. What is really in the world and be honest. And when I write characters who are not like me, I try to approach them first, like Omar said, as a human, as an individual, not somebody who's representing anything or standing in for anything, but just this is a character, this is a person who lives in this world. And I try to base them on my experiences on people I know in particular who maybe share characteristics with that character. And that's my process for it.
Cool.
Excellent. Anybody else? Rebecca.
I just wanted to bring up, and people have talked about this, but not used the word sensitivity readers. I think that they're very important. And it's another way to do your homework. It's another way to check in with people from a community that you are trying to represent respectfully in some way. So I think that whenever I attempt to write outside of my experience, I'm always going to find a sensitivity reader before I try to put that out for the wider world.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That extends even more to not even just ethnicity or gender. I think it extends to pockets of communities. I just did a comic called A Graphic History of Hip Hop. And I'm a alternative rock, black rock guy. And so here I am, even though I was around that all of my young years working in that environment, now I've had to approach it. I won't go into the kind of the friction that came about when I was doing the book from those who were around me sometimes, but it's that you have to treat it almost like an actor. Okay, I'm a straight actor, but I'm playing a gay character. You have to do it with honesty. You can't really judge it, right? You just have to go in and say, okay, what is the most truthful thing that you can adhere to? And always recognize you're serving multiple masters. For me, sure. I've been doing Afrofuturism since I was 12, 13. Right. That's always been my gear. And of course, the joke I use, which is I always get to laugh, is obviously it's made me a very wealthy man. lately has been nice, but that's because the world is now caught up to the idea of stories about people of color. That question is never asked to a black creator. How do you write white characters so realistically? It's never asked because you just grew up swimming in it. Yeah. But alternatively, and I'll end with this, so I love the new Halo show. Love it. It's great. Great military science fiction. But why they have to almost kill all three guys before the show's over? You understand what I'm saying? So it seems so random. And I know what they were doing, and that's fine. But I'm just tired of seeing black characters die on screen like that. Mm. You know what I mean? After a while, it's dehumanizing, which is why I made a book about a black man who literally can't die. You know, I keep going to that because it's, you know what I'm saying? When I'm saying you're serving two different masters, right? What you're doing is you're trying to tell a compelling story, but you're also trying to fulfill a need inside yourself. It's like Rick Rubin says, your first audience is yourself. And then it's the audience.
Yeah.
I was trying to add one thing on what Todd was saying. The number of years that gay actors played straight characters and no one ever said a damn thing because they played them right, because they simply played them as human beings.
Right.
And that's the real key to everything, is just don't, I have to have a black character in here, not unless the story makes sense to have it. On the other hand, if I have a black character in there, he's got to be a character. He's not just got to be, it's 20 minutes in, he's got to die now. And
wearing a red shirt.
It really comes down to serve the story, you have to serve the community that the story is for, which is the people reading it.
There you go. And that's one of the mantras of tell the damn story. Serve the story, serve the story, serve the story. Hopefully with French fries. Call for that one. I'd like to get to our third question and then unleash the audience. Yes, Janine.
I just want to say I'm learning so much. Like being a new writer, I am still, I think, at the place of write what you know. But like everybody said, as long as you're treating your characters with empathy and we're all in the same place, we're all human beings, I think that you can get to the truth of the character and serve your story well. But this is all really good for me because I'm learning stuff. So that's cool.
Find out how to learn what you don't. Jersey,
yeah. I just want to piggyback on what Janine just shared is that I think there's a stance issue that's embedded in this too. Whereas if you have a rigid stance and you're saying I'm the author and I am bringing like in teaching, you've got like the sage on the stage versus the Socratic method, right? And I work with teachers like I'm filling you with knowledge. I'm like, actually, in the Pokemon theme song, you teach me and I teach you. It should be a two way street. and I remember 10 years ago when somebody taught me the term crisscross applesauce. And I remember I roared with laughter because my world just got bigger. I was like, oh my God, I never saw what I was saying. Thank you. And these teachers were very shocked by that attitude because they exist in a world where there's a correct answer and incorrect answer. Incorrect means you failed. We're in a room with failure. And I think part of the empathy I'd also try to bring to people who get a little bit like rigid about this is, yeah, that's the world you live in. You always feel like you're being tested on this stuff. But artists could be the rule breakers who say that everything is welcome here. Let's pretend, let's play, let's be expansive. And when we don't know something, that means we're about to learn something. And that's awesome. That's a really cool thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I was blessed with was when I was a teacher was students like Omar Holman who would come up and say, can we learn about this? You know, and it was always the best unit of learning. He assigned me, he wanted his spoken word poetry. He wanted to learn about that. And I said, of course we can. And luckily it was like a Friday. And I ran right to Barnes & Noble and picked up every book I could. And I studied all weekend.
That it's funny to hear because I'm like, hey, can we do this? And like, I guess I just, and you're like, yes. And so I'm like, yeah, I'm like, you're a teacher, everything. Like, okay, so I'll see you on Monday. I never thought of what it would be like for you. I thought you'd just be like, yeah, you show up Monday. Okay, boom, I know everything. I didn't think of, oh yeah, I ran out.
Now I can tell the damn story. It was 48 hours of hard homework, buddy.
I'm shocked. I thought you knew everything too.
The reality here too is that you had a teacher who was willing to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Which ties in back to what Jersey was saying about being open to, and thanks for the Pokemon reference, Jersey. That really just brought it home. You know, let's get to that third question there, sir.
Yes, sir, because audience questions are coming. So everybody eye a quick exit. So this one talks about a topic that we almost would prefer not to have to talk about, but again, to share the experience, which is one of the core things of Tell the Damn Story. It's felt necessary from early on all the way through. And that's, we have often discussed imposter syndrome, depression, and creatives' mental health, especially in our current divisive culture. Since we on TTDS share our own experiences to ease the path of other creatives, what do you do for yourself to combat those challenges and to support your own well-being?
I watch a bunch of anime.
There you go.
Sometimes I think there's like a, I guess there's, because their comfort shows have become such a thing now, and I don't really be watching shows like that. But I'll rewatch certain moments, like Naruto, right? My favorite character is one character can't do the same things other guys do. He can't shoot fireballs or anything like that. All he can do is rock you with it hand to hand. That's what he excels at. Ain't no other chicks. I run up, I punch you in the face. That's it. And his journey is really hard because he can't excel the way others can. He has only this one thing he can do. And I'm just seeing his journey through that, and it's almost like a mirroring of whatever I'm going through. I'm like, man, I'm over here feeling bad about myself under my weighted blanket, but freaking Rock Lee's out there doing 500 push-ups, and if he fails, he does 500 sit-ups. If he fails that, I'll do 1,000 squats. All right, let me get up. So it's always like going back to something like that, or just another piece of media that will make me feel good. Like, I know how it ends, but like the journey of getting through that to that, it's the comfort of knowing how it ends, but also, okay, it's a rough patch. Ooh, there's the light now. Okay, I can maybe get up there. I can maybe get up and finish what I was going through now.
Excellent. Carol.
I know very well that when we are writing, we are typically sitting in a chair all by ourselves with luck, no distracting sounds and all. But that can really leave you, guess what, alone. So one of the things that helps me a whole lot is to hang out with other writers, whether it's in our New York chapter of HWA or whether it's people in my local writing group, or I have a group of gals, we get together every Tuesday night and we sit and we write while we're online. We don't talk during that time. We just do the work, but there's somebody there with you and helping and supporting you. And I find that makes a huge difference, because if you're doing this all alone, that's what you are, alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't say enough about how much when I found the HWA, or actually they wandered into the haunted house I was working at, which is true. They really did. It allowed me to know that even though I still feel like I'm on the outside on a lot of stuff, there are other people that are on the outside, even if we're alone together and they have the same problems. And they talk about, I can't figure out why this character just won't leave the story, or I can't figure out how to get this character into this room or whatever. Stupid stuff that nobody else on the flicking planet knows. I found finally a writer's group after many years, a couple of times of trying horribly that didn't work, about almost 5 years ago. And we meet weekly now. Got me through COVID. We went from once a month to weekly during COVID. And now it's the highlight of the week. And I'm now in a second group with a bunch of writers who astound me with what they create. And I still feel like, what the hell am I doing with these guys? But it is incredibly uplifting. And for me, it's old samurai TV shows. That's my comfort food. What's great is because they're subtitled, I can't do anything else while they're on.
Yes.
I can't be depressed. I can't also be writing because I'm obsessive. And I just, and they're absolutely formula, and I don't care.
I just need to, I need to follow up on this. I don't know if you guys can see this. This is a mug that my, one of my writer friends and I found online, and we both got it. And it says,
Alone and together. Yeah. That's cool.
Drinking from the mug and knowing that my best friend in the mystery world over there, she's drinking from it too. Yeah.
That's cool. Rebecca, thank you.
You mentioned imposter syndrome in the list of things that can get people down when they're trying to do this hard thing. And I learned, I have to credit my friend West Moss for this. And yeah, it's in our book, so you should grab our book, that the comparison game is always, you're always going to lose. Playing that game means you lose. Everyone loses when they do that. That everybody has their own path. You have your own path. It's not the same as someone else's. They have a different life. They have different challenges and opportunities. So the only thing that you should really compare is, am I doing more than I did before? Am I trying new things? Do I have more publications than I used to? And the answer is going to be yes to that, right? 3 years ago, I didn't have any books. Now I have two. There's no reason to compare myself to someone who has 10. Like, they're on their own journey. Just trying to look back at what the past you wanted to better appreciate what you have now. And when I, and I'm not always good at that. Like sometimes I have to remind myself about that, but reminding myself of that does help.
That's well worth it. Yeah. I come from a Bronx Irish Catholic culture. So self-loathing was a cornerstone and it's been a lifelong process of trying to extricate myself from that. Who else? Jersey, sir.
If I could make an observation about Alex, one of the things I admire about him so much is that he embodies wisdom, but also childishness and childlike wonder. And one of the things, when I think of self-care, I think of reminding myself that, oh, I got into this because at some point as a kid, I really liked it. Right. And that can get obfuscated by trying to do some kind of like thinking of every time you're being creative as having some kind of utility. You're making something for somebody else to see and react to. So something I've been doing recently, and it has been life-changing for me, is making art without objective or purpose. Just sitting down with a book that I don't show anybody. I don't show it to anybody. It's not for anybody. It's for me. And getting to sit in a space and be my own friend, the difference there is it's not loneliness, it's solitude. And it is very enriching. And it reminds me why I got into this. And then I really do feel like there's a Alex Simmons Obi-Wan Kenobi ghost watching me when I'm doing that.
Jersey, I'll second that, because the Teledam story exists because, and the blackjack rapid read exists because I have offered this to, or asked this, or pitched this to a lot of different people, different ideas, and Alex says yes. He has always been open. I mentioned something to Rebecca, and she said yes and worked for 3 months and created that book. It's that kind of thing, saying, yeah, or what if, that keeps us going. Even to quote one of the chapters that Rebecca, she has great chapter titles, Believe Beyond the Doubts, has been really personally helpful for me because I majored in doubts and really got good at it. Yeah.
I have to bring to attention the fact that if we're all holding to the hour mark, we have about 12 minutes left of that. And I know at least one of our fighting force here will hit the silk at that time. So I just want to...
At this point, if it's okay with everybody, let's turn the questions over to Alex. And you, as long as you all agree not to hold me responsible for whatever the hell happens next.
No guarantees, dude.
I'm gonna try and fit as many of these in as possible, which means that what will probably happen is maybe one or two people will respond to the question, and then we'll jump to another one like that. We'll see what we can get done here.
So these are audience questions, Alex.
Audience questions. These are questions that were written in throughout the week by various individuals. So here we go. Okay, so actually this is close to something that someone already asked. Do you go in with the ending when you start writing a project? Do you go in with the ending already in mind, or do you let the story play itself out? Who wants to tackle that one?
I'll go quick on that. Sometimes I've written the end of a book first. I've written the epilogue before I start the book, because other times I'll know where it's going. But other times I will literally just start with a scene or a mood and write until the book finishes itself. I can't do that if it's contracted, you know, because they want a freaking synopsis before you write the book. But going back to what Jersey said, sometimes I write for me. When I write for me, I just go on the journey, and when it's finished, and then I see if I can sell it somewhere. But I wrote it because I wanted to go on that journey.
Beautiful.
And those are the ones often where I don't have the end exactly. I just have a feeling I want to have people walk away with.
Gotcha. Anyone else on that one? One more? Okay.
Same.
Oh, go ahead. What? Same? Good. This one that says, what was the first piece you ever wrote that made you think, I want to do more of this? I want to be a writer. Wow.
I'll jump in.
Go ahead, James. They don't all jump at once, yeah. Right?
Okay, James. All right. Yeah. So I think when I was a kid, actually, I must have been like 8 or 9, and we got an old electric typewriter, and I got permission to play with it. And the first thing I did was write a like 6-sentence story about my Shogun Warrior toys. And that was just so fun. Putting life into these plastic characters in my own head, I was like, yeah, I want to do more of this. I probably didn't think about doing it professionally at that point, but I definitely knew I was going to write more stuff, and then did over the years, obviously.
I'll quickly say that I've always been a storyteller, even as a kid. A lot of the stories I made up got me in trouble, but that's another story. But in terms of knowing that I wanted to do this professionally, was after reading Something Wicked This Way Comes. Cool. And the opening lines of that, I went, I want to be able to do that. And I went after it. So that was my answer to that one.
Just quickly, I read, I guess I was 7th, 8th grade, I read S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders and ran out and got a notebook and a pen. And basically plagiarized the entire book, but it was just the process of writing. And then I realized, wow, that's really Hearst. I didn't know it was a Herb at that point, but that's S.A. Hinton's story. But I like this thing and wanted to see how I could write my own stories. It took a little while after that, but S.A. Hinton's to blame.
Okay, so, here we go. How many hours a day or week do you spend writing? Does anybody have a pattern or a system?
Yeah.
Every.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tim, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, but go ahead, James.
No. Go
my answer is simply every.
Every.
Every hour. Every hour.
I'm thinking about doing it or planning to do it or regretting that I'm not doing it. So. Mm.
Yeah. Teal just finished another novel while we were listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in an interesting place in my career. I have to put anywhere from 8 to 15 hours a day and 6 to 7 days a week, because it took, as Alex and Chris know, it took decades to get to this point, because I went for many decades in my career where, yeah, I was in that group that started in the late 80s and 90s. A lot of these guys who are big, they're my contemporaries. My career didn't never really went anywhere, although I did the Marvel thing and that whole thing. But now, due to Afrofuturism, it's popped me into another gear in my own personal life, just being, not understanding how important it was. And I repeat this like a broken record, you all knew it was going to come, about finishing things. Once I got that and I docked that like a spaceship to each other, it has altered the course of my life. What I did not realize, however, is that once you collect one thing and you demonstrate not only that you can finish and that it's cutting edge and it's good, people will want you to do more of it. And then your schedule can get packed. So that's where I am now. So I'm overdue on one project. I got to turn in to Marvel tomorrow. And then I got to get back to W.E.B. Du Bois's The Comet, which I got to trying to finish. I just signed a book deal. I can't say who I signed with yet till they do what they're going to do. But that's where I am. I'm 57 years old now. I know what it's like to have nothing. So I'm like, oh no, we're going to eat at this buffet table. Yeah, there, pass me some of those deviled eggs. I don't even like deviled eggs, but I'm going to eat any. So that's where I am at this point. Okay. Alex, I just got to learn how to take care of myself.
We got Janine and Carol.
Sorry.
I just got to say, you need to clarify, Alex, if you mean actually typing or all the time that we're cleaning the house or doing the yard work or whatever while we're trying to avoid doing the typing.
Gotcha.
It's always in there.
Injection there, Carol. Yes, Janine.
I think no matter if I don't write all day or if I'm thinking about writing, doing the dishes, or if I manage to eke out an hour or two on my own, or if Tom and I are writing together and we write all day, it never seems like there's enough. Like, I haven't done enough. I need to do more. Or I should do more.
I'm saying you should. No.
Yeah, I should definitely write more than I do.
Then let me throw this one in there. This one here is, actually, we've got some international questions here. One from Africa, one from another part of Europe, or a part of Europe. So the one from Europe is, how can you stop writing and go spend time with your family?
You don't.
So does this go to that health factor that Chris was talking about? How do you take some time for other things, or do you just go? Okay, Tim?
Yeah, I think it's important that I'll answer this question. Okay. You must take time, because if you don't, you'll end up like I did in December with cords all in your body because you're high blood pressure and hypertension. I was almost dead in December.
Don't do that.
Exactly. So I now have to pull back. Now, although I work those hours the way I do, my diet has completely changed. Was this 64 ounces a day of water? It's part of you. We are athletes. And as athletes, there's a certain amount of conditioning that goes with being an athlete.
Yeah.
You have to be able to perform the task and the duties. And part of that is connecting with your family, your spouse, your children, whatever. And it could be as simple as sometimes just a phone call or a text, but sometimes, yo, man, come on, boy, get up. I'm taking you out to dinner. That type of thing, because that feeds your soul, that feeds, it lets them know that you give a damn. So it is really a relationship. So relationship to work means maintaining a relationship with the people who you love.
Tim, I'm going to say the unspoken part, and that is, if all of us were to be 100% honest right this second, even at the biggest family reunion, part of us is going, okay, so Penelope flips over the gangster's head. We're still in the back of our head.
Yeah.
I've got
might
one
be talking to Aunt Lorraine, but
gonna jump soon. So I got this one for Omar here. Is it? Can you tell us your source of inspiration? What does it take to get you going?
Oh, what does it take to get me going?
Oh, no, your source of inspiration in terms of what fires you up, or where do you get your ideas from, and that sort of thing.
He better mention that.
I guess
that's all I'm saying.
I guess that is a good inspiration. I think it's the I like talking about things, and I don't want to use their dead name, but there was a poet that once said how a really good job of a writer is, how can I make you care about this thing I care about, but you don't give a damn about? And so that's like a real, I go through that. I really like niche things. I love Cars 3. I love Lightning McQueen. I think he's the greatest. LeBron James, Serena Williams, Lightning McQueen. That's my of athletes. And in doing that, how do I get them to understand these things? I'm really passionate about it, but also because, especially as we see now, we're like, with WB and HBO, we're like, they've taken all these artistic projects, they've cut and taken away just for tax cuts and things like that. So these things people poured their heart and their soul into, these shows and things like that, which, oh, that was all part of streaming, right? You'd be able to have access to all these things. They're gone now. And who will remember this? I love the show Final Space. You cannot buy the first, second, or third season anywhere. And it was cut off before they even got a chance to finish the show. So the guy had to struggle to make a comic out of it. How would you know about that? If you don't know about that, then you don't know about it. I saw it. And so it feels, my inspiration is like, more people need to know about this. So it feels like one, being a fan of something, one, to champion it, and also being like a reporter as well to talk about like these things, like people need to know about this thing and why this is great. So that's one aspect of it. And then also just, I guess that's the other aspect aside from, oh, I enjoy this and it's funny to talk about. Like, oh, you need to know about this thing. And I'm talking from like a position, because I write like essays, reviews and things like that, or like why this media was good. So like getting people informed about something and like this, especially like this, it's a shame when something comes to cult classic because like it didn't have a big, like a big outbreak, whatever. Okay, it was an all right movie. Oh, we appreciate this thing years later down the line. So I think if I can appreciate it now, you know what I'm saying? Maybe that gets more people around it, centering it now too. So it's always just one to stick up. I love an underdog. I love an underdog. So it centers there. I want you to know about this thing that's really great and more people need to know about it. And it's such a shame that more people don't know about this thing because of any these number of circumstances.
Perfect. Thank you. And if you do jump off while we're still talking, I love you, man. Thank you so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you for having me, guys. It was a great meeting y'all.
That was very cool. Check them out on Black Nerd Problems. I tell you what, Omar's work on pop culture is not to be missed. He is insightful and hilarious. And this energy is 1/10 of what you see when he's performing. So check him out.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank y'all.
Okay.
Yeah. And I learned from Chris. That's why. There you go. I'm taking my compliment as I leave.
Peace, bro. All right,
so I will just throw in a couple more questions here. Actually, I've got quite a few, but I'll just throw in as many as I can. This one is, this is a funny one. How do you manage to keep into your head or work through in your head all the lines, the characters, the circumstances, the relationships, all of that material? How do you work it through? What's your process? What do you come at first, or does it just all come to one big crash on a 6-lane highway?
Rebecca?
I want to say it doesn't, and that's why we have to revise 7,000 times, because we forgot that this person met that person back then, or it's June, not March, or whatever. Like all these pieces, especially I have a novel in progress, and I've already been at it for 2 years, because I'm like, still figuring things out, or I forgot something and I got to go back and rework a scene to add in the thing I forgot. There's no way anybody can keep all that in mind at once. And it's why you can't sit down, write something and send it off for publication. Writing is a lot of work, and that's part of it.
I have
Tom.
I have quite a few of my friends I'll be talking about a particular project and how it's like weighing on me terribly. And they'll look at me and they'll say, oh, you forgot the mouse. And that's from a previous novel that I wrote that had a mouse as a main one of the characters that I completely forgot about the sequels. So I had to go back and insert the mouse and restructure the story to have the mouse do what the mouse was doing in the first book. So it made sense. So yeah, that's the big thing. Oh, you forgot the mouse.
There you go.
I guess I'm the weirdo on this, because I have an Altiva, my fantasy world. I have 6 novels and, I don't know, 20 or 30 short stories in it. And I will very occasionally have to go back and look up, is Lucas the god of just vengeance, or is that Skira? But they sit in my head all the time. Maybe it's because I don't have a social life, but I literally, it's all there. I have not, I don't forget eye colors or any of that stuff with any of my characters. And I've got, I think it's at this point, 61 separate series characters. And I don't forget them. I guess it's why I don't have room for anything else in my head.
Jersey, I just want to see if you want to add something to that.
This is something that maybe Tim and I both suffer from. Is we like, I don't, Tim, do you do model sheets for your characters?
Oh my God. Don't start, man. And you don't want to do them, but you have to do them.
Yeah. And yeah, when I don't, I, all of a sudden I'm like, well, wait a minute, I had to draw them from behind now. What does the back of their outfit look like?
There you go.
Yeah, and that slows things down. So yeah, I can't hold it all in my head either. And although for character voice, I'll often try to come up with a little slogan for each of them and how they see the world, right? This character's, their outlook is, how hard can it be? This character's outlook is that I know how to do this, and that'll get me going. And that was inspired by something I heard voice actors do, is they'll come up with a signature line for their character to get back into that character kind of thing. Yeah. But
trigger.
For the most part, what?
Like that a little called? Trigger. Yeah, trigger.
James, you got something on that?
Yeah, I write a lot of short fiction. And what I used to do to get around that was I avoided writing series short fiction. So every time I was writing a story, I created a whole new world, a whole new cast. I just had to remember it for the duration of that story. And I had a writer friend who has since passed away, but he wrote a lot of series short fiction. And he just didn't get why I was doing it the way I was doing it. So that's a lot of work. You're creating a whole new world every time you write a story. And recently I have been writing a short story series, a steampunk series, and now I'm finding it, I got to do a lot of homework every time I write a new story. I got to go back and read the past stories and say, what was the timeline here? What was this character's name? What was their relationship? Who did, what kind of hat was this guy wearing at the time? So my way to get around it originally was just not to, to have a lot of continuity, but writing longer fiction, yeah, it's definitely a lot of go back, reread, make notes on key details and things like that. Right. And I like Tim and Jersey were talking about model sheets, and I have written sort of character model sheets or just quick character sketches. So I have a memory that, okay, this one tends to wear these kinds of clothes and is this height and that kind of thing.
Beautiful. Let me just try and get this one in here, because again, I'm trying to be aware of time. What is one of the most memorable mistakes that you made? And what would you do to encourage writers to do to avoid that? Or how would you have writers avoid that? So your most memorable mistake, and how would you encourage writers to avoid that going forward?
Are you trying to say that I make mistakes? Wait.
No, I would never say that to your face, Carol. Never. Never would I say that. Tim first, because he had his finger up, and then we'll go back to Carol.
Yeah, I would say, particularly for young writers or any writers these days, because I don't think we're not in as much of a youth-oriented culture as we used to be due to the internet and technology and stuff. It's, oh, I'm young and sexy. Oh, no, that doesn't apply anymore. It's, can you get the work done? So I would say, I'm drawing a blank here because I'm forgetting the question.
What was your most memorable mistake?
Yeah, be intentional. In your career, design your career to taste. Do not allow yourself to drone from one experience, career experience. I'm not talking about just regular life, but career experience from one event to the next, assuming that you will create the works that you want just because you're talented. That's not enough. You have to be intentional about what you're doing. And I've never said this before. Years ago, Art Spiegelman asked me to draw for Raw Magazine. And I didn't. Because at the time I was 20, I was very young, and I was very dumb, right? And there's not a year that goes by where I don't think, what if I had just kept my mouth shut and just did the work he asked me to do? It was only going to be about 4 or 5 pages, but no, I had to get into all this other stuff. And I said, dude, not everybody has these opportunities. How about you shut the hell up and do the work?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's, I hope that's, I don't know if that's a good answer.
But be intentional. Yeah, because
be intentional. Not being. Sorry, I didn't mean to drone on a little bit.
No, that's all right. No drones. Carol, did you want to say something, or were you just having fun with me?
No, I was just having fun.
Oh, okay. Okay, Janine?
Yeah.
I being a former teacher, I always encouraged my students to just give it a try. And if you make a mistake, it's okay. We learn from them. And I am the worst person at taking my own advice.
Yes, you are.
I'm working on it. Now I make mistakes all the time. And sometimes it's hard not to feel like a little seventh grader going, oh, I did that wrong. Oh, that was dumb. I should know better. But the truth is, if you don't make mistakes, you'd learn nothing. You learn more from your mistakes than you do from your giant successes. Keep making mistakes.
Okay. No mistakes, just opportunities for improvement.
Yeah.
Let me fit in two more of these. Like I said, there are more, and maybe you guys will take write-ins at some point or something like that. Okay, what did professional anyone work in specify? Nope, that's not it. Are the stories better written by the... Oh, okay. Are the stories that you write better inspired by true experiences or your imagination? So I think what they're asking there is, which is a better source, coming up with stories from your imagination or writing stories based on true experiences, things that you've seen and that sort of thing? Yes.
Rebecca.
Head to head, yeah.
I think every story, no matter like how wild it is, going to have some kernel of true inspiration in it, right? You saw someone on the street, or the weather was a certain way one day, or I don't know, you base a character on someone you knew 20 years ago. And that's for any genre. I think that's for like fantasy and sci-fi, right? Things that are so far from the real world. There's probably still something in our world, even if it was someone else's work, you could be watching a show or reading a book that is totally otherworldly, but there was something in that inspired you. Well, that story existed in real life and you took a kernel from it.
That's the stuff that enhances the imagination.
Right?
Mm. So you take the building blocks of somebody you knew or a place that you saw or something, and you use that to enhance stuff that's coming up out of the coconut.
Yeah.
Let me ride that. Tom, stay with me on this one. A question that might tie into what you were just saying is, does visiting a place or a country or something like that inspire you? In other words, do locations and things like that also factor in?
I don't go anywhere, so no. though I have had people tell me how, ask me when I visited places and but talk about that I've never been or seen or anything.
But you've written about those places.
I've written about them, but and they've asked me when I visited that country or visited that city or whatever.
Okay. So, anybody else want to jump up? Yes, James. James first, then you.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's something I have done on occasion. If I'm writing about a place, I'll go there if I can. Even if it's not the same place, I remember writing a short story set in the historical Five Points neighborhood of New York City, and that was accessible. So I went down to that part of Manhattan and just walked around for a while. One of the things that I've done in recent years, and this is funny, is you can go just about anywhere of significance in the world on Google Maps Street View. Just last week, I was walking, not literally walking through the Great Pyramids to just get a sense of scale at the Pyramid of Khufu and the burial ground across from it for a story I was working on. A few years back, I made a comment online about, gee, I'm so happy I could go to this particular Antarctic camp on Google Street View for a story I'm working on. And I was surprised that half a dozen other writers jumped on and they were like, oh yeah, or have you seen this camp in Antarctica or doing the same thing? So I do try to get that real feel for it as much as I can, whether I can get there in person or it's virtually.
Okay, Teal?
I was just going to throw into what Janine said about making mistakes. And I've had a lot of jobs in my life. I've worked a lot of careers. And that feeds everything I write. I can go back to what Tom is saying. If I've been there even for a day, I can do it. But if not, like Jim said, I will read everything I can. I've had people tell me, how did you know how much that cost on that bus in Hong Kong? I looked it up. Fake it till you make it.
Yep.
I'll just add a quick thing on there. I wrote a story, an adventure story that took place in Africa. And I really grabbed the opportunity and took my advance and paid for a ticket and went there. And the one thing that I got out of that I could not have gotten out of any of the virtual methodologies or reading about the was the smell, was the sense of smell and a temperature in certain environments. It really brought home certain things that were very important to me later when I was writing that story. But yes, sometimes if you can go to the location, it's very useful because your other senses will get fired up and you can use that later to help create authenticity. I'm sorry, somebody else was going to say something?
I think it was Tom.
Yeah.
Did you have something, Tom?
No, I already spoke.
What I'll say is when you can't go, James said, use the maps, Google Maps or whatever. But yeah, Alex, the map is not the territory. Being there is different than looking at it on a screen or reading about it. So if you can get there.
Yeah. As much as I would love to continue this, because boy, this is fun. we're at that mark. I just would love to give everybody an opportunity. First, let me say thank you, everybody. Really, thank you. Thank you. Let me see if I can get some balloons going here. Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for really participating, for sharing, for being so open and honest and real about this. And of course, you've been here before, but you've got an open invitation to come back to this house anytime. And I would love to get a few of you back here together in another sort of this writer's council thing, because this is fun. This is very informative. Cool. I'm learning and I've been around for a while. So
we appreciate your generosity, and it's a great way to mark 300 episodes with your wisdom and your heart. So thank you very much.
And do you want to say anything, throw out anything to our audience? Any thoughts, tips, whatever?
Promos, whatever.
Just congratulations to you guys and all the work you've done for a long time. And what a gift you've given everybody 300 times over now. That's wild. So thank you. Congrats. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I often think about if I had the internet when I was first starting to write, a show like this would have been amazing.
Yeah.
For real.
And this one is. Yeah. There's a lot of really great people who've come through it.
Yeah.
And most of those are still on YouTube or on wherever you get podcasts. So you can check out older issues, episodes of Telling
This
Story.
This is being recorded. Obviously, Facebook is going to keep it for a little while. And then, of course, we've recorded this and we'll put it up on our YouTube channel. So all of you who were not able to be here live, you missed. Check it out in a little while. Give me a chance to get the technology and move it over. But there'll be a recording of this for you to enjoy and hopefully pick up. And I'm sure, Chris, I speak.
Great opportunity to like and subscribe, Alex.
Yeah.
Why don't you say that again, Chris? Because I love hearing
it. It's a great opportunity. Hit that like button, hit that subscribe button, and hang out with us as you learn and you get ready to tell your own damn story. So
absolutely. And please leave questions and comments here on our page or on our YouTube page, or send us an email or any of that kind of stuff. And we'll try and get answers for you, because that's what we do. Because as Tom says, we don't go out. Yeah. Okay. Again, thank you everybody who's been here on the show. And thank you everyone who's been here watching the show. It's been a pleasure and a blessing. Thank you so much. And Chris, as always, love you, brother.
Love you, brother. Love you.
Take care, everybody.
Peace. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
All right.